Hello, everyone. This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Andy Nowicki, and we're going to be discussing his book, Lost Violent Souls.
Thank you for having me on. It's good to be with you again.
So a lot of people, they're going to pick up this book, and they're probably going to assume that it's a book about the Kennedy assassination, but it's totally not what it's about. And it's not really, and one of the obviously, I listened to your interview you did with Greg Johnson, and you did touch on that, but it's not really about that. It's a series of stories about different people, but it touches on this overall theme, and I think this theme is a continuation of some of the themes you touch on in your previous work. So I guess what I can start off with asking you is, how does the theme of this book relate to the themes of your previous work?
There's a lot of ways I guess I could answer that. But I guess that, this was something that was most recently referred to by Matt Forney in his excellent review, a very complimentary, although not totally complimentary, he wasn't just completely kissing my ass in every way imaginable. He had
he's very blunt.
He's blunt, yes.
He doesn't care about offending you, but you appreciate that. You don't expect him to kiss your ass.
Oh no. He didn't completely, when I say he didn't completely kiss my ass, he didn't kiss my ass in any way, but he was flattering. He was nice in most of his commentary on the book. There were a couple of things he didn't like, and he had no problem saying that either, and I appreciated that as well. Although I wish he had liked those too, but so can't please everybody all the time.
I remember I interviewed Matt Forney, and you were interviewed on his website.
Yes,
and you kind of agree, but you have some areas about sexuality, especially where you have a disagreement.
Right.
He thinks you're a total prude or something.
Well, now you're trying to cause trouble between us. I thought things were cool with me and Matt. No, yeah, I mean, you're probably right. Traditional sexual morality, and I guess Matt probably doesn't. But there are a lot of ways that a lot of things we do agree on, and Matt's been very, very kind as far as the attention that he's given to my writing, the reviews that he's written, and how he's helped, I think, increase my readership or pique some people's interest in my work, and so I'm very grateful to him for that. But getting back to your question, as far as what the themes that are in this work that have been in things that I've written before, I think that there's a lot of themes that are, as a writer, you're stuck with yourself, you're stuck with what you've got, with your interests and obsessions and fears and hopes and dreams and.
So do you get people saying, "Oh, this Andy Nowicki guy, he's a little too obsessed with these kind of characters, like the spree shooters and Columbine?" You probably get that a lot.
I get that some, yeah. or they say he's a little too obsessed, or maybe they think he's just obsessed enough. I don't know, depending on where you come from, but a lot of what you get out of it is what you bring to it. But Matt also talks about that in his review. And Matt's not the only one who's reviewed my work either. There's been a couple of good reviews. Celia Davenport wrote it up for Alternative Right, and Julie Howard Hobson wrote also a very complimentary review for Countercurrents, I appreciate.
And it's published by Countercurrents.
It's published by Countercurrents. That might be a conflict of interest, some might say, but like Countercurrents is going to write a bad review about one of their own works, right? But it's a worthwhile review, and I appreciate Julie writing it very much. Now, what Matt referenced in his review is how, in some ways, each story centers around the question of suicide, which I guess is nothing new for my work. My very first published novel was called Considering Suicide, and it was all about the question of to be or not to be, Hamlet's, you know, famous dictum, the question that he asked himself. Whether it's better to go on living or to die.
Well, it's a kind of a theme because you're actually, as you said, you're coming at it from a standpoint of a Christian or Catholic morality, but there's definitely this theme among the characters of nihilism.
Yes. I mean, I'd say I approach, I think of Dostoevsky a lot when I try to compare my work to somebody else's, which sounds like I'm giving myself too much credit, and I don't mean to say that I am Dostoevsky. I certainly wouldn't claim to claim anything of the kind. But as far as being someone who is both interested in faith and sees the necessity of faith and is in certain ways very devout and definitely practicing my faith, but who at the same time is aware of the doubts and the challenges that assail the mind.
And it's part of the theme is finding a redeeming quality in people that society views as the most absolutely reprehensible.
Yeah, or yeah, I mean, maybe in some ways, sometimes the reprehensible ones, and sometimes just the ones who are left out or who are thought of as losers or as not really worth paying attention to.
So they're not sociopaths, but they're people who maybe start off as being for the decent people, but they've become more marginalized and they feel rejected by society, and that leads to who they become.
I would say it's a continuum between and what we mean when we say sociopath. That's I don't have a problem with the term, but it seems like it's gotten overused in the last 3, 4, 5 years, where everybody's saying everybody else is a sociopath. But you know, my characters tend to be on a continuum, with sociopathy being up on one extreme and some of them are just likable, sweet guys, but who just are really having a hard time. and most of them are somewhere in the middle, I guess. You know, there's some something kind of frightening about them, perhaps, or something that might be alienating to certain readers, but hopefully something that's intriguing at least, and something that some readers would definitely gravitate towards or see or recognize as something within themselves, whether or not they would care to admit it.
Yeah, well, you've touched on that. So you've said that you've identified with some of your characters. I mean, it's probably doesn't sound good to say, but characters like Tony Meander in The Columbine Pilgrim, mm-hmm. or say the character in Heartkiller, for instance.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I definitely, I would say, I talk about extreme sociopathy being on violent, you know, murderous, sociopath, being on one extreme, one end of the spectrum. And I would say Tony Meander would be that, the protagonist. I won't call him a hero, but the protagonist of The Columbine Pilgrim. And most of the other characters that I, whose point of view I'm writing from, aren't quite that extreme, but still have something of that in them. And that would also be the case with the cast of characters that we have in Lost Violent Souls.
So I guess where we can start off is obviously, as I mentioned in the beginning, when you pick up the book, It's a Lee Harvey Oswald's mugshot. So I kind of made the point how some people might pick up the book, and if they don't know anything, they might assume it's a book about the JFK assassination. And that's obviously that the anniversary. I think it was the 50th. Yeah, the 50th anniversary that happened recently.
Right.
And yes. I know Oliver Stone has been making movies about the conspiracy theory stuff. And I don't know. I mean, I'm not really that stuff isn't really. I'm not that interested in the. I mean, I know a lot of people are interested in the JFK conspiracy theories, but I'm not. I don't know. I don't really think it's necessarily worth getting into. But you talk about Lee Harvey Oswald. You talk more about who he was as a person.
Yeah, it's the entire book is not about Lee Harvey Oswald and the Kennedy assassination. There is one story out of five that there are five stories, which are thematically linked, but they're all separate stories. And one of the stories is called Oswald Takes Aim, and it's about Lee Harvey Oswald. And you say you're not into talk about not being into conspiracy theories. I mean, the point of view that I take in this story is that Lee Harvey Oswald was the only shooter.
So you take the mainstream version in a sense.
In a sense, although I've heard that more people believe the conspiracy version than the lone killer, lone shooter version. But I do tend to think that Oswald acted alone. And I know people, I know a lot of people don't, and that's fine. We, you know, reasonable people can disagree, although they might not think I'm reasonable for thinking the way I think.
Yeah, it's actually more politically correct to believe in the conspiracy theory than to take your position of humanizing the Lee Harvey Oswald and really looking at it from his perspective. That's more controversial than the conspiracy theory aspect.
Well, yeah, Gerald Posner has a book called Case Closed about the Kennedy assassination. And in that book, whatever its merits or demerits are, a good point that he makes, and also Gene Davidson, another author, wrote a book called Oswald's Game. It's a lesser known book, and it's actually what I'm thinking of is more from Gene Davidson's book. But she makes the point that the real Lee Harvey Oswald was not the kind of guy who would be involved in a conspiracy. You know, the whole idea that the conspiracy people, like in Oliver Stone's JFK and other places as well, they tend to posit Oswald as the patsy, you know, as the guy, you know, of course, it's this big conspiracy that comes in and they shoot Kennedy from all these different angles. And the kill shot comes from behind the grassy knoll. And I used to live in Dallas, so I would go to the area, and it still looks very much the same as it did back then, which is kind of eerie, the Dealey Plaza area. But anyway, the real Lee Harvey Oswald would never have wanted to collaborate. He was not a collaborator. He was very much a lone wolf. He did it his way. You know, he had a big ego. He wanted to stake a claim to make a name for himself. He wanted to make a dent in the world. He felt like he was, this loner, this loser, this put down, put upon guy. He had a chip on his shoulder, and he was determined to make a name for himself in one way or another, and he did it. In my view, and I think that if you really study the man, Lee Harvey Oswald, that's the character study. That's the kind of character that you're confronted with, and it really doesn't square with the conspiracy theory version of Oswald, where he's just a cog in a machine, and he's a collaborator, and he does what he's told, he takes orders, he's a foot soldier, as Jim Garrison, the character in JFK, puts it. That's not the real Oswald as I've understood him. So in my story, Oswald is the main shooter, except in my story, He's not the shooter. The premise of Oswald Takes Aim, the story, which is the second story in the collection of Lost Violent Souls, the premise is that Oswald gets cold feet as he's sitting there for the motorcade to come. He can't get himself to assemble his rifle because his hands are shaking. And so so the motorcade goes by and his opportunity passes and Kennedy lives.
An alternative history.
Correct. It's an alternative history. And it asks the question, you know, what would have happened if nothing had happened that day, if no shots had been fired, and the motorcade passed through Dallas, and Kennedy went on to speak at whatever engagement he had. And so it's set in that world, this alternate history. And of course things go, wildly different than they go in our, a timeline, but the focus of the story is in this alternate timeline. It really is about this man, Lee Harvey Oswald, and how he, what happens to him, what experiences he has, over the next few years. And in fact, the story takes place 10 years later to the day of when he was going to, commit this earth-shaking act that never happened.
So would you rather not spoil the alternative history part? You'd rather keep that a surprise for the readers.
Yeah, I don't want to give everything away, but suffice it to say, it's a very different kind of world, but maybe not so different after all.
You touch on the relationship between him and his wife that he married in Russia, Marina.
Yes, that's a part of this, a big part of the story, it was a troubled relationship, it's an interesting one, and it's an interesting one to analyze, just to try to make sense of exactly what Marina ever saw in a guy like Lee Harvey Oswald.
So was she genuinely attracted to him, or did she have some opportunistic reasons for marrying him?
Well, that's, you know, it's all speculation. But I would say my guess is that, that it was probably largely opportunistic. Oswald spent time in Russia. Of course he wanted to defect because he was a communist and believed in the Soviet system at first for a little while as a very young man. I think just, you know, like, I don't know, like 20 or so.
You don't necessarily, ideologically, you're not necessarily the same, similar to him per se.
Ideologically speaking, no. I mean, I I'm not a communist, never have been. Well, actually, no, I have been, but back when I was 16, I was a communist. So maybe we do have that in common. After fashion, in a teenager, rebellious teenager kind of way. No, it's not really his ideological. It's not him ideologically that interests me. It's his, again, his incarnation as a lost violent soul, as someone who is in some ways an orphan in this world, in this modern world in which we find ourselves, where faith has slipped away, the sea of faith has receded, you know, so little of the old certainties remain, we're bequeathed these kinds of characters. At least this is my whole perspective, the way that I cast the issue here. And Oswald strikes me as somebody who, again, the whole, I don't think we talked about the title yet, the title of my book, Lost Violent Souls. The title comes from the T.S. Eliot poem, The Hollow Men, And in that poem, the speaker talks about how those who have remembered us, if at all, will remember us not as lost, violent souls, but only as the hollow men, the stuffed men. And so the poem is drawing a distinction. I maybe have talked about this before. Sorry if I'm being redundant. But the poem is drawing a distinction between the hollow men of modernity, the kind of men who...
people who... The kind of your average person who all the... I think Matt Forney pointed this out. They mm-hmm. care about fucking, eating, and watching TV.
Yes, that's right. I was reading an article about Albert Camus today, who wrote a book. I can't remember which one it is right now, but he had the same sort of critique. This is the age of people who fornicate and read the newspaper. It's that sort of thing, you know, where we can't even work up the gumption to even commit a sin that's all that interesting. Our sins are just boring and banal and bland and everyday.
So your characters, they are sinners, but at least their sins are a lot more interesting and exhilarating.
Yes, these are the kind of people who are committing, who have the guts, if you want to call it that, to sin boldly as Martin Luther.
What is a cowardly sin then?
I think C.S. Lewis actually discusses this in his very interesting novel, The Screwtape Letters, where he talks about how, I think it's maybe from an essay. That's a part of that, or was added later. Screwtape proposes a toast. Anyway, in that story, it's about a demon trying to get people to sin so that he can, you know, get them to go to hell. And he says, you know, in this modern age, we've perfected the system where we can get people to go to hell without even doing anything all that interesting. You know, they just do the
so yeah so I mean maybe before hell was an interesting place, but they've managed to make hell as boring as hell.
Hell, yeah, exactly. Hell is just bourgeois.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah,
these days. So and I'm not, you know, it's bad to do bad things no matter what.
You're a Christian. You don't advocate sin, of course.
No, I'm not an immoralist. But I do think that there's something, and this is, you know, what Eliot's point was in the poem also, that there's something to somebody, you know, sinning boldly rather than just sinning almost by out of habit, habitually, just because everybody else is doing it, just conformingly sinning the way that many people do these days. And so Oswald is one such lost, violent soul, even though he, in my version of things, he gets cold feet. Still, he gets points for trying to do this thing that in our galaxy, in our dimension or incarnation of reality, really did shake the world and change history.
What is the role that sexuality plays in this book? I know it's been a theme in some of your previous works.
Well, it's complicated. In one of my stories, Morning in America, the one that opens the collection.
So that's the first one.
Yes, the first of the five. We have the premise of this story is it's a meeting between two young men who are about to do something terrible. They have plotted this massacre that's going to take place on this day, and they're going to die. At the end, after having committed this, they're going to end their own lives, and so I'm interested. It's in just capturing the moment before the disaster, when everything seems like it's going to be a normal day, but apparently it's not. And you know, this is the point of divergence. This is, you know, or the moment before. It's like the I don't know if this has ever really happened, but there's these old pictures of a piano falling off of a roof, and, you know, like somebody walking down the street. And so this is the moment where it's like a frozen shot of a pedestrian walking down the street, and there's a piano 5 feet over his head, but he's just walking, you know, without a care in the world, not knowing that this piano is bearing down on him. And that's the moment that I'm trying to capture with this story. Anyway, these two characters who are both teenagers in the throes of the puberty, the ravages of puberty, they talk very angrily about sex and how what it's done to them and how it's led to their humiliation, being high school losers, being the put upon, the ones who are spat on.
It's back to the theme in the Columbine Pilgrim and Heart Killer.
There are similarities, yes. It was a story that I wrote a couple of years ago, actually, and it was after I wrote the Columbine Pilgrim, but before I wrote Heart Killer. And it's in the same sort of milieu, but done in a different way, in a third-person omniscient, as it were, or semi-omniscient perspective. But thematically speaking, it is similar. So for them, the sex is mentioned as a source of humiliation. And for other, in other stories, sex comes up as the thing that led to complications in people's lives, and that led in some ways to people to these characters becoming corrupted in ways that appall them. This is the case in a story called The Wooden Buddha, where the protagonist is this kind of pitiful guy who's a high school English teacher.
Yeah, you're an English teacher.
I am. Yes, I am. That's true. So there's some autobiographical some autobiographical convergence there. I don't. But believe me, this is a fictional story.
Okay.
Just like everything else.
Semi-fictional.
Semi. Yes. Sure. But anyway, so in this character's life, sex. You asked about the role that sex has played. He perceives sex as more of a something that's corrupted him. And of course, and over the course of the story, he has he's in a very troubled marriage. His wife is basically has endured trauma from a couple of miscarriages, traumatic miscarriages, and has more or less given up on life and just become this pitiful housebound really nasty, mean kind of person. And he has an affair with a coworker, which also has its own complications. So you have sex in some ways, portrayed in a way that where it's a humiliation, where it's like a kick to the gut or a kick in the teeth, a way in which the people who are more popular, more attractive, and so forth, just lorded over you. And then there's also the sense in which sex comes along and is perceived by the character as this corrupting agent that leads them all kinds of places that they don't want to be. And then the final story in the collection, a story called Motel Man, which Matt didn't like.
He liked the rest of them, but he didn't care. That was the only one he didn't care for.
That was the only one he didn't care for, and I'm really, I told him this. I was really happy that he said that, because I think it gives the reviewer credibility if he says there's.
Yeah, I mean, I know I'm on Countercurrents, but I got to be honest. I think the Countercurrents review was it was too biased since they Countercurrents published it. Matt Fournier was more brutally honest, I would say.
Yeah, well, I prefer to think that Julie's review really, really liked it, and not just that she said those things just to say them. But
I'm not dissing her. It was a good review, but I mean, I think to be objective, you have to say at least one negative, one critical thing.
Well, like I was saying, it does add it does make people, it does put the reader at give the reader some perspective and help them to know this isn't just, you know, this isn't just a kiss ass kind of job that the reviewer is doing here. Anyway, Motel Man, which Matt didn't like, but other reviewers have, is a story in which the character has more or less scrubbed himself clean. And so we have this, you know, we were talking about the extremes, the different polarities
Well, of course, Matt Forney doesn't like it. I mean, Matt Forney, my joke is I call him the Howard Stern of the alternative right.
Yeah, that's a good moniker. But in Motel Man, the protagonist is not has we don't really know much about his backstory, but he is somebody who has just sort of like the Buddha after enlightenment has taken all of those sicknesses that he had in his soul, and they're gone. He's purged them, and now he's just this hollowed out man, living to who's dedicated to this secret band, this secret order that wants to undermine the materialism of the world, and so for him. For him, sex is not an issue. He's gotten past it, and not just sex, but all other kinds of corruptions of the soul. so it ends. You could say it ends with a happy story, or probably a lot of readers wouldn't think that it was necessarily happy.
You don't want to necessarily spoil it.
No, I don't want to give it away. Again, like with the other stories, I won't say what happens, but I do think it's a way of thematically speaking, just sort of taking things to a logical conclusion as far as this collection of lost violent souls that we follow throughout the book. Here's the last of them, and here's what he does, and it in some ways, you know, closes the door, slams the door shut on everything that came before it.
I remember a while back you wrote this story on the alternative right, but I'm curious, is it from this book? It was. Remember the story you wrote? It was about a guy in a mall, and he was staring at this girl who was working at a mall kiosk. Is that from this book, or that was something else?
Oh, that is that's something else that I'm working on at present. That's part of a sort of what you're referring to. That was on alternative right. Since all the chaos has happened, I don't know whether it can be found anywhere right now.
Yeah, all the old alternative right stuff. Most of it's gone.
Yeah, the archives of 2013 can be found. They were put up at the Radix Journal site, but after February 21st, it's not up anywhere. But what you're referring to is part of an excerpt that I gave some of the alternative right readers, which some of them appreciate.
There's these kind of two factions, and that's what is fantastic about this movement is its diversity. You have different you have different points of views. Not everyone's always agreeing, but I know were a few of the pickup artist types were really like saying, "Oh, that Andy Nowicki guy, he's a total loser for writing this."
Yes, Yes, they were, and they were making fun of me, and that's fine. You know, I can take my lumps, but.
And I don't think Roosh is probably not a big fan of your work.
Oh, I don't know if Roosh is even aware of me.
He probably doesn't even know you exist.
No, he probably doesn't. But that's something that I'm working on now, and that's partly a treatise and partly a memoir. Like I said, most of the fiction that I've written, you know, we talked a few minutes ago about what's biographical and what isn't, what's autobiographical and what isn't. And it's all semi-autobiographical. There are some things that are very much not autobiographical in the least. For example, Tony Meander's killing spree, and other things as well. What I'm working on now is a kind of autobiography in a way, but it's also kind of a reflection on sexuality and on living in a highly sexualized age, and how, in some ways, the ultimate rebellion or the ultimate nonconformity is choosing not to be sexualized. That's something for listeners to look forward to. I don't have a title for it yet, and I don't have a venue for it yet.
So it's a book. It's a book you're working on.
It's a book I'm working on, yes.
So we'll save that for when it comes out, and we can...
Yes.
Okay. Is there anything else about Lost Violent Souls?
There's The Poet's Wager and The Wooden Buddha, which are similar in that they're both about a troubled man and his female psychiatrist, and the troubled man is considering suicide for various reasons. In one of the stories, he's lost his job and he feels there's not much reason to go on living anymore. And the other one is the story about how his wife has miscarried and this has devastated her and made her into a kind of walking zombie and monstrously mean and a woman. So there's that through line there. And then it ends with the one that we talked about just now, Motel Man, which is the culmination of everything. In some ways, that's the Lost Violent Soul perfected, gone to such an extreme, who's sunk so low that now he's shed all of the sin, shed all of the, you know, if you want to call it sin. I guess readers will feel different ways about it, but who's gone to that extreme and has now scrubbed himself clean and become this different kind of person, this Ubermensch. Maybe you could even call
it. But with your characters, their acts of rebellions are these extremely violent acts. I mean, you're advocating rebelling by being like celibate and square. Isn't that a little too tame? Like, people think, isn't that kind of tame? People doesn't really sound rebellious as a...
Well, it doesn't, but it is. I mean, that's the thing. It doesn't sound rebellious because it's not cool. But the thing is, what's sold to us as cool is, you know, if you buy into a rebellion because it's cool, then what are you really rebelling against? It seems to me you're just doing what's expected of you. And this is a theme that I'm elaborating on in what I'm writing. What we were talking about a minute ago, my autobiographical treatise. And I may seem more extreme than maybe is necessary about some of this stuff, but extreme age. So there needs to be a corrective, and that's what I'm trying to provide.
You wrote another article about masturbation, and you were joking. You were saying that instead of gay marriage, gay homosexuality, gay marriage, you should promote a self-marriage should be the next frontier.
Yes. Yes, and it was all a lark. It was I was taking this idea of marriage equality, which I find completely ridiculous and absurd, but of course it's what you have to believe these days or else you're a hater. The idea that you should be able to, whatever your inclinations are, you should be able to marry whoever suits those inclinations, because anything else would be discrimination. So I said, well, why can't you just marry yourself? Maybe masturbation is as valid a form of sexual intercourse as sexual intercourse is. Again, it was a lark. It was a satire. Something taking this argument to an extreme to make a point. But I'm always kind of a little shocked at how some people don't get it. And if you have to explain that you're being satirical, that kind of defeats the purpose. So, so I don't know, maybe, but I think that, some people got it. Some people maybe missed the boat. Other people maybe just didn't miss the boat, but I don't know. We're just sort of lukewarm about it. But anyway, it was a satirical piece. I just want to say that now, just like things I've written before.
Since you've been discussing this topic, how does this topic relate to some of the more recent spree shootings? And I know you mentioned you listened to the interview I did about Mark Ames's book, Going Postal.
Yes. Yes. Oh, well, gosh, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to know. You don't really, like I've said before, a lot of this is just speculation. We can't really know what motivates these people to do these kinds of things. Obviously, they're at the end of their tether. They've reached their limit in some way or another. Something has snapped. Whether Ames's thesis is true to the extent that he thinks that it is, I don't know.
But everyone has their own theories. Like the Manosphere, they say spree shootings are all about sexuality, and if the guys only learned game, they wouldn't be spree shooters. And Mark Ames, he has a very strong focus on economics, and he puts a lot of the blame on Reaganomics and the economic system where you have corporations screwing over workers. So all these people have their own theories about why they're happening. And these are outside of the mainstream. I mean, the mainstream says these people are simply evil lunatics.
Yeah, sure. Right. And they don't want to even deal with, asking for reasons, asking for why it happened is like, in some people's minds, is like trying to make excuses for their actions, which I don't think is true at all. We can try to understand something without excusing it. But yeah, you're right. That's kind of Ames's entire thesis. And there's something to that. I mean, there's something to the, workplace humiliation, people lording it over other people, people just getting the shaft and the kind of endemic cruelty that you find in some, some human, some forms of human interaction, the pecking order, how it can get out of hand, all those kinds of things.
Do you believe in a pecking order? Are you or somewhat of an egalitarian?
Well, I think that, I'm not an egalitarian at all. I think we obviously have different abilities and different aptitudes. As far as social organization, how the state should be organized or what the rules of the state should be or anything like that, I'm not a big theorist on those kinds of things. I'm not a fascist or a national socialist, I don't know. Libertarianism is it kind of bores me, really. I'm not offended by it, but it just doesn't really excite me that much. I just think whatever system we have, things are going to be rotten because people are rotten.
And you were saying you way. Actually would rather, you're kind of tired of politics. You would rather focus on the spiritual aspects of things.
Yeah, I'm not a big political thinker. Sometimes a political story catches my eye and I write about it. But that's only very occasionally. I tend to be bored with politics. I very strongly oppose the whole politically correct zeitgeist, the Kali Yuga, or whatever you want to call it, of the present day. I really see it as a waste of time to get involved in these kinds of endless, you know,
you're not going to be some leader of a big movement of all these different marginalized, lost, violent souls out there.
No, I don't think so, but I don't know. I mean, and most people don't know who the hell I am, but every then I have somebody, you know, write me or something saying, you know, talking about how they love my work and how they, and sort of like they're in awe. They're like, it's like I'm a rock star or something to them. And again, this is not that often, but the few times that it has happened, it's been very flattering and also very strange.
You may have a growing cult following out there.
Yeah, well,
because you write about dark subjects, you're gonna attract some of those people.
Yeah, I think so. I think that it's a niche, but I think in some ways, this whole scene that we're a part of is a niche, and it's a, as we said, a big tent. You know, there's a lot of different people under this tent with a lot of different perspectives, but who are united as far as who we're against.
Because in the mainstream, everyone among the politically correct sites, everyone has to think the same. There's no diversity.
Right.
I think it's fantastic. I pointed out how there is this debate you have between the pickup artists, a hedonist, and people like yourself.
Right.
And how you're very much, you have opposing views, but you're part of the same movement, and you're identifying a lot of the same issues, and they don't necessarily, they're not necessarily your opponents, they're just tackling these issues in a different way than you are.
And we're up against something that's, a thousand times more powerful than we are, as far as not as far as the ideas, our ideas are powerful, but as far as just the might and the amount of resources at their disposal, our enemies are far more powerful than us, and so until that changes, you know, it would be really silly for us to turn on each other with too great a ferocity. I think that we should at least have a tactical alliance with the others under our tent. And that's what I've advocated that for a while. You know, I'm all for sharing the foxhole with others who I wouldn't necessarily.
I can just picture it. I can picture it. You right now, Andy Nowicki's there. And you have your glasses on, and you're reading a book, and then there's the pickup artist, and they're dressed up in their flamboyant clothes, and are the guys with the tattoos,
right?
And you're all there together, hovering in the foxhole,
right? That's right. I mean,
maybe that could be a book cover, that image.
Bedfellows, like I say.
Yeah. So before we wrap it up, I guess if you want to plug your next project, I think we touched on it. You haven't decided the name of that book.
Well, that's the autobiographical treatise that we've talked about is something that's still in the works. But actually, I do have another work that something I've written that I'm very excited about publishing through Ann Sturzinger's company called Hopeless Books. And it's something, it's a novella that I've written called Beauty and the Least. And this is something that should be out in, let's say, in the next couple of months. And again, it's something I'm excited about it because it's, I'm publishing it again through Hopeless Books, which is the imprint of this new company that was started by Ann Sturzinger, who's a friend of mine, who wrote a book called Nevusquam or Nowhere, that was published by Nine Banded Books, the same company that published my first novel, Considering Suicide. The Talkative Corpse, which she's also published. And it's a slightly different readership. And so I'm hoping to expand my palette, hopefully reach people who haven't heard of me
before. Are you implying that they're more mainstream?
I don't know if they're more mainstream, but I think they're just different.
Well, though I wouldn't say they're mainstream. She's right. Kind of has a dark theme, but when yes. I say mainstream, I mean outside of the alternative right political sphere.
Yes, I think so. I mean, Anne has identified herself as an antinatalist, which is getting into opening a whole different can of worms here. Basically, the antinatalists are people who are so down on life that they think that it's better produce.
And that's kind of the opposite. Along the alternative right, there's a lot of natalism.
Yes, well, we got to get the white race. The white yeah. race is a problem. We got to have babies to buttress our race, or else we're going to get swamped by all these other peoples, and die out. Yes, it is the opposite of that. In some ways, of course, it's not racially particularist. It's saying this applies to everybody, to all human life. That there's something tragically sad about human life. And
she's not. I think is she an atheist?
I'm not sure if she would call herself an atheist. You should talk to her sometime.
I interviewed Matt Forney and I talked about the Nevusquam book, mm-hmm. and he described her as a secular antinatalist Andy Nowicki.
I guess that could be said. She's a fascinating person and a really nice girl too. So I've got this thing coming out with her imprint, her company, again called Beauty and the Least, which is I don't even know if I want to go into too much detail describing it right now. I could say it's a story of obsession. There's a fantastic element to it. It's kind of got a little bit of a fantasy. There's some question of where fantasy and reality converge and where they diverge. But it's a story about a middle-aged man's obsession with a young girl. There's a passage in, for anybody who's interested, I go into detail about in my first book, Considering Suicide. There's a passage there. And for anybody who's interested, you can look it up on YouTube. I did a segment with a friend of mine. Just type in Poet of the Mall, Andy Nowicki. I did a segment where I read a passage from my book where I'm talking about the mall setting and what it represents and what it meant to me growing up. Just to bring it to a conclusion, I'm very happy to have this project through Anne's company, and everybody who wants to check it out, maybe you could put this in your show notes, hopelessbooks.com, and a lot of good stuff there.
So I think we covered a lot. So Andy Nowicki, I'd like to thank you for being on.
Well, thanks again, Robert, for having me. It's been fun, and let's do it again sometime.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.
Countercurrents Radio is the voice of Countercurrents Publishing and the North American New Right. Visit us at www.countercurrents.com. That's K counter-currents.com.